what you're doing for New Year's?
Oh, no.
What is wrong with New Year's?
Well, nothing for you. You have Palo. You don't have to face the horrible pressures of this holiday. Desperate scramble to find anything with lips just so you can have somebody to kiss when the ball drops. Man, I'm talking laugh.
We had a good run. You know, what was it, 4, 5 months? I mean, that's more than most people have in a lifetime. So goodbye, take care, bye-bye then.
I'm getting married today!
Woo! Morning, Ross.
I'm getting married today!
Yeah, you are!
Oh, woo-hoo!
I think you knew I was here.
I'll be there for you. I'll be there for you. I'll be there for you. 'Cause you're there for me.
Welcome to another edition of the Retro Room. This week we're talking about Friends. Yeah, the great iconic 90s show. Been off the air for more than 10 years, but it's still big on reruns, still big in the lexicon of America, we're finding out, and it spawned a new book, I'll Be There For You, the one about Friends, about the ins and outs, ups and downs, and background information by Kelsey Miller. We spoke to Kelsey. She gave us some great insight on what went into the book, what went into the show, and why it still resonates with a lot of people. First, I want to remind you that my new book is out, Killing Journalism, How Greed, Laziness, and Donald Trump are destroying news and how we can save it. That's at Amazon.com out of Willow Street Press. Check it out. Let me know what you think. And of course, let's thank our sponsors, Jiminy's. Jiminy's Dog Treats. They are hypoallergenic, sustainable, and better for your dog than beef or chicken. That's Jiminy's at Jiminy's.com. Jiminy's.com. And now back to the show. And here's our interview with Kelsey Miller. Kelsey, are you there?
Yes, here I am. Hi.
Great to speak with you. Of course, you're Kelsey Miller, author of I'll Be There For You, the one about Friends, which is a great title because it's such a takeoff on the names of all the episodes. Your book on Friends that came out just this year. It's a good topic. It's funny. It's a timely topic in that a lot of the Friends fans, I think, are growing up, and it's interesting to look back on these shows. That's one of the reasons I like doing the Retro Room, is you get a little distance from some of the shows and movies of even just a few years ago. But Friends has been off the air for a while. What was the years that it ran? It started in 94.
It ended in 2004. It's been in syndication,
yes,
you know, since its second season. So one of the things that's been interesting to write about in the book is that it never really went away. In fact, you know, it's on Nick at Night now. It's on multiple different syndication outlets. So it was interesting to write a book about it now.
Right. And you talk in the book about how you came across watching it on reruns while at the gym, I think, at one part of the book.
Yeah.
On TBS. So it started out on NBC, but obviously reruns are a whole different world, and the fact that you sort of got into it on a rerun schedule. Talk about, for people who haven't read the book, but hopefully will, the way you sort of got into it, as you explain, and then what you found out about it that you wanted to tell people.
I grew up on the show, actually. I was 10 years old when it debuted, and being 10 years old in the United States, I mean, I don't think that you could grow up, you know, unless you were living in a very particular sort of community where televisions didn't exist, or magazines, or news, or anything like that, without being exposed to Friends. So I did actually watch it when it was first on the air, and the finale happened when I was in college. And it's like, in those intervening years, I didn't watch it regularly, I don't think. I'm pretty sure I fell off of it when I became the age to watch Dawson's Creek and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But then I came back to it at the end. And then, as you say, there was this period in my life when I was in my late 20s, and I was going to the gym. The funny thing about going to the gym is that you notice that you look around and everybody is kind of watching rerun television. They're either watching like cable network news or they're watching cheesy reruns. I was watching Friends. It was sort of the perfect cardio companion because it was, you know, it was just sort of light and fun and familiar, and I could drop in and out and I could be like, oh yeah, I remember this episode, or I forgot about this episode. Slowly, I realized though, it was sort of fulfilling an emotional need for me that I didn't quite realize. It wasn't just my gym show. It was a show that was about a period in my a period of life that for me was ending. I was exiting my 20s, going into my 30s, and, you know, entering that phase of life where people are getting married, where, you know, you're not seeing your friends as much, perhaps because everybody's busy with, you know, their careers becoming more solid, perhaps they have children. And on Friends, it wasn't just revisiting this show from my childhood, it was revisiting really a period, that period in my own life. So it hit all sorts of nostalgic and sometimes sad, sometimes, you know, fond memories in my own mind.
And give people a little background on you prior to this book so they know what your writings have been about. And you wrote some interesting, you have a different path you've taken in another world, talking about weight loss and women's self-images. And tell us about that and sort of what you've done in the past related to book writing and promotion of ideas.
Sure. Yeah. My first book was called Big Girl. And the subtitle is How I Gave Up Dieting and Got a Life. Because I was writing about pop culture at the same time as I was writing about that stuff. I was working at a website called Refinery29. I started working there, I think it was 2011, 2012. And I was doing a lot of different kinds of articles. So I was sort of what they called an agnostic writer. Pop culture was one of my big beats. And that's why I ended up writing about Friends quite a lot, because at that time, Friends was sort of the resurgence was building and it sort of exploded around the time that Netflix picked it up. But at the same time, I was also writing this very popular first person column called The Anti-Diet Project, which was really about my journey. Well, what happened when I stopped, when I just quit dieting after a lifetime of doing it? You know, I think I, like a lot of people, I had sort of grown up in the diet cycle and sort of was living either on a diet or between diets and trying to, you know, fix my problem body. And this was sort of a revelation to me, what the moment that I sort of gave up on all of it and found this new path. And I started writing this poem that was about intuitive eating and unconditional body acceptance, and in fact, stopping the sort of battle for weight loss and instead focusing on, you know, unconditional body acceptance and body positivity, and relearning basically how to eat and how to exercise, you know, in a truly, truly healthy way without the sort of goal of manipulating your body. And so that led to my first book, Big Girl. And so I've been really lucky to get to write about a variety of different things.
And so that leads you into, and it's interesting, you talk about weight loss and healthy eating and exercising, and then you talk about going to the gym and getting rehooked on Friends. But the other thing about Friends, what do you think was the impact it had at the time it came out? You said 94, to two, so it was on 10 mm-hmm. years or 9 or 10 mm-hmm. seasons. That was an interesting shift in the U.S. in many ways. It was on early in the 90s when we had President Clinton. Then it was on during his impeachment and a lot of things that occurred in the 90s. And of course, September 11th hit, and you have a chapter about mm-hmm. September 11th's impact. Did it serve a good purpose, or did it kind of gloss over some things that were going on at the time? How did the show fit into that time in our pop culture and in just American life?
Yeah, that's one of the things that I was so fascinated to dive into. You know, even thinking about it in terms of 9/11 and after 9/11, this is a show that existed in both of those worlds. And, you know, as I'm sure you recall, the world felt entirely different after that point. I think that from the beginning, Friends reflected a lot of sort of social views and political views, and certainly became so big that it definitely influenced them, and it influenced us in ways that we don't even think of, as I write in the book. Our speech patterns, our style, of course, certainly changed television forever. And it became one of the most popular, if not the most popular, representation of American life in countries abroad. It played quite sincerely a role in international relations, as many in our own government would say.
How did that occur? Is it shown overseas more than a lot of other shows, or did you see impact overseas? I didn't realize that.
Yes.
I don't know if a lot of people did.
Yeah, it was, in the end, it made it to something, syndicated to 220-something countries, and it's translated in almost 200 languages. It's all over the world. It is everywhere. And it became this thing, this representation of not only America, but of New York, for so many people. I spoke to people in the book about this. I even spoke to one of my own best friends who grew up in Switzerland, and she said, you know, yeah, this is what we thought America was. This Friends was America. They were synonymous. And that's why they expected everything to look like it did when they got here. I mean, not to, you know, diminish, everybody knows that television is television, but I think there was this understanding that this massively popular show had to be reflective of the American people and of American life. And even I wrote about some people using it as a learning language tool. You know, parents in other countries will actually put their kids in front of, you know, the DVDs or rerun episodes after school, because it is, for many people, a great way to learn English, because you can pick up on the context cues and things like that when you're watching it. And it's also a compelling sort of story as well. And it's funny. They're very, you know, there's like some physical comedy in there. So it actually can be a good language learning tool. And international relations thing, I am not recalling the exact study, but it was one of the many sort of research projects that happened after September 11th, when everybody was trying to figure out, okay, how can we reduce radicalization abroad, and how can we reduce anti-American sentiment abroad? One of the papers found that these reruns of Friends were actually doing a better job than our own government propaganda at creating positive attitudes toward Americans.
And I think it had a kind of mixed effect. I mean, some people would say, if that's the representation people have of America, it's kind of a misleading representation. One of the things I think the show got criticism for, you mentioned this somewhat, me and my friends talk about, the show has six white, very attractive people who have no money but live in these great New York apartments, which is very misrepresentative. It also was a great way for a lot of people to see what the generation was like, that you had young people who were struggling, were dealing with relationship problems, were dealing with money problems, and very open sexually. It was one of the first shows. I'm 53 now, so in 94 was 20 years earlier. I was a little bit older than that group, but not completely out of that generation. Very open sexual show, in terms of people were sleeping together all the time and people would jump into bed with each other. Now, was that a good representation of what it was really like, or was that kind of an unfair but necessary breakthrough? Or maybe I'm going too deep into it. But of the first part, the sort of good-looking white people group who are living pretty high on the hog in New York with no money, did that misrepresent, or was that just sort of the fantasy of TV?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I mean, it's both. It was the fantasy of television. It's absolutely ridiculous. And, you know, frankly, I think the most sort of egregious misrepresentation is, as you point out, this is a show about six white people, and it went on for 10 years, and they didn't have, you know, a reoccurring black character until the last year. And there are very, very, very few people of color who even appear in speaking parts on the show.
Is that something they got criticized for during the run, or not really?
They did. And that really is saying something, because at the time in the 90s, you look around and TV was incredibly segregated.
Yes.
It was far more segregated than it was now. And even so, critics pointed out, like, okay, this show is actually really, really white. This is even whiter than we're used to.
How did it deal with that? You talked to the producers in the book. Did they try to make things different, or they'd say, look, this is one show, don't give it a hard time, this is who we are? But it was also such a hit show, and as you say, getting international attention and people thinking that's what the U.S. is like, in reality it's not. How did it sort of get away with it, or was there struggles along the way we might not have known about?
I think that there was certainly talk about this. I mean, you can look back to there's a Rolling Stone article that was the first sort of cover story that the cast did together that came out at the end of the first season, that was part of the reason that they blew up that summer, the show blew up that summer. Mm-hmm. In that article, there's a discussion between the cast members, because they're about to go, this is right before their first Oprah appearance, and they were like, okay, what do we say when they bring up the people of color thing? And I think back then, unfortunately, I mean, television is still overwhelmingly white, of course, and it is still quite segregated. But back then, it was easier to say, like, you know, okay, everybody's doing it, we're just following the norms. I mean, I don't think they were really out to shatter that particular norm, unfortunately. As you say, they did push the envelope in a lot of other ways, which now, I mean, it doesn't look like envelope pushing now, but to have two women get married, and to have, you know, even to have like a single parent, and to have to show like single 20 siblings having a sex life, you know, that was considered very, very risque. They weren't allowed, you know, they were constantly fighting with the network over, you know, being able to say the word condom. So it was a different time. And I think a lot of people use that it was a product of its time excuse as a way to sort of well, yeah, to forgive the show of everything. And I don't think you have to do that. I think you can say, yeah, this is a product of its time, and it was a time that was far more bigoted and less inclusive.
And it came after the 80s when you had some different shows. You had The Cosby Show. I mean, taking away what happened with Bill Cosby later on, at the time, his show was a big hit. It was considered a cultural change because you had the opposite of a lot of black family shows. They were poor or middle class or struggling. This was two professionals, mm-hmm. kids who were well disciplined and lived in a nice neighborhood. And there was basically, it was Bill Cosby's sort of comedy forum, but it was a big hit. It was a bit segregated too. I mean, it had some white characters come mm-hmm. in and out. And then you had Roseanne, the first Roseanne, at around the same time, where you were talking about poor, sort of Midwestern, down and dirty people who were dealing with a lot of issues that weren't really on TV. And then you shift over to Friends, which was dealing with a younger demographic, a younger group, growing up in the new generation. I wonder if that was sort of a shoot back to sort of the other issues that had come up. And how did the show try to do something different? Or did it just sort of evolve as a funny idea?
Well, at the time, certainly all the networks, all the big TV head honchos were looking for a show that would speak to Generation X. They were looking for something to talk to that market. To, I think as Warren Littlefield put it, who I quoted in the book, I think he was like, you know, young people living in cities, not just New York, but, you know, these cities were all blowing up, like St. Louis and Austin and Chicago and all over the place. And how do we speak to them? Because as you say, you know, the most popular shows on TV at the time were, you know, you had the family shows or family-oriented drama comedies and workplace comedies as well. You had Seinfeld, of course, but they wanted something that spoke to that up-and-coming generation, and nobody was quite getting it right until Marta Kaufman and David Crane came along with this incredibly low-concept show, which was, they're just friends. They're friends. This is a show about the time in your life when your friends are your family, and that is the entire concept of the show.
Right, and the interesting thing for me, as I said, I was in the 90s, I was in my 20s, living in San Francisco. I had moved mm-hmm. to San Francisco from New Jersey, where I now live again. And it was a very similar experience in terms of, there were a lot of people in San Francisco in their 20s come from other cities. I was meeting a lot of people and had roommates, and just like in the show. So yeah, it was talking to my generation, was probably talking to a lot of other people like that. And the other thing to remember is that was the powerful Thursday night lineup, right?
Mm-hmm.
There was the show The Single Guy, which was, I'm forgetting the actor's name.
Jonathan Silverman.
Yeah, which I thought was a really funny show. I don't know. It lasted a couple seasons, I guess. And then you had Friends and The Single Guy, and there was one other.
Mad About You.
Was Cheers still around then? No.
Cheers went off the air in 1993, yeah. But you had
but Mad About You was the other one. So it was, these were the lineup. You had the Friends who were young and unmarried. You had The Single Guy. You had the new married couple in Mad About You. Then you had Seinfeld, which was its own animal. And did that play into it too? How much did Friends help that lineup, and how much did that lineup help them?
Oh, gosh. Well, certainly at the beginning, I think being placed sandwiched between Mad About You and Seinfeld, which were the two most popular shows
sure.
on television at the time, absolutely that helped them. And then, of course, the same year that Friends debuted, ER came out as well, and that became a giant
That was the 10 o'clock show, right?
Yeah.
So yeah. I don't think any network's had a lineup like that since.
And
of course, television's very different now. It's so splintered, but that was such a powerful lineup for many years.
It was. And certainly in the beginning, you can see how the lineup, as you say, helped Friends, because you had these very early crossover episodes, like the famous Thursday night blackout stunt that NBC pulled that they actually did quite well, which was, you know, they sort of realized all of NBC's Thursday night shows in primetime took place in New York City. And so they did this thing where they were like, okay, well, we're going to make it so they all have a blackout. And so one of the characters in Mad About You caused the blackout at 8 o'clock. And then at 8:30, there was Friends. And then there was the show Mad Men of the People. The only one who didn't participate in the blackout stunt was Seinfeld, because at that point, Seinfeld was sort of known for, you know, they didn't want to play the game, and they'd earned the right to say, no, we're not going to play your game. But it was a really sort of great, exciting thing. And I think it kept a lot of people tuned in. So that certainly helped Friends in the beginning. And you even have some early crossovers like Caroline in the City that sort of came into Friends. And you had the ER guys coming in to do a cameo early on. And then as Friends blew up, then it sort of became the ballast. It sort of became the one that was helping out the other shows. And so you had mm-hmm. Friends characters hopping on over to other NBC shows that were in need of a little support.
And we first saw on Mad About You, we saw Phoebe's twin character,
yes.
Right? She was the waitress. But Mad About You came on before Friends. In terms of the timing, it was on the air already.
It was on the air already, and it did come on, you know, right before Friends in the time slot as well. So Lisa Kudrow had already been playing this recurring character who popped up every now and again. Not a constantly recurring
right.
character, but somebody who was known. And somebody who was, she was a character that was popular. She was getting some notice in press for that character. And then when they wanted to cast her in Friends, the Friends creator had to go over to the showrunner of Mad About You and say, hey, is it okay if we make Ursula a twin? Just so it's not, we can't just have the same actress back to back on two different shows on Thursday night. We have to rationalize it somehow. And the showrunner said yes.
Yeah.
And
that was a great idea.
Now,
and then Ursula appeared
yeah.
on Friends. And didn't she go out
yes.
with Joey?
Yes, she yeah. went out with Joey. And then
which
Ursula eventually, yeah, Ursula became like a reoccurring character on Friends. And when you think about it now, it's such like an old school phenomenon. I don't think that would ever happen on television now in quite that same way.
The other thing about Friends that I think is interesting, again, we're talking to Kelsey Miller, author of I'll Be There For You, the one about Friends. Her book is out on Amazon and other good book locations. It just came out this year, just came out recently. Mm-hmm. A really good read on a lot of the pop elements of Friends, but also some of the great background. And that's my favorite stuff about these shows and movies, is hearing the inside stories. The other interesting thing about it, I thought, while I'll be somewhat critical that it was always this sort of misleading representation of six good-looking young white people living beyond their means, there was great comic ability, especially, I think, among the women characters. I think women in comedy never get the attention they should. You look at Jennifer Aniston and Lisa Kudrow, Courtney Cox. The three of them, very attractive women, very positive on the air, but very funny, almost in a Lucille Ball kind of way. You know, Lucille Ball in her day was considered a very attractive woman, but mm-hmm. was such a good physical comedian and made fun of herself. I think the three of them really pulled that off well. They went beyond just joke one-liners like some sitcoms do. There was physical comedy. There was making fun of themselves. There was two good-looking and unusually attractive and white people, but they made fun of themselves. They got into bad situations. They had problems. Some of the comedy was really, you could even argue they were funnier than the men because they were so good at it, especially Jennifer Aniston. I think she had a great approach to just making fun of herself, physical comedy, and all three of them were goofy and had bizarre, embarrassing problems that maybe a lot of actresses wouldn't have put themselves in.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, as you point out, a lot of the commentary around the show in the beginning and probably even now is like, okay, we've got six pretty people and that's why people like the show. And it totally just wiped away the fact that you had these incredibly funny and well-matched people. And certainly the women did not get any of that notice. And they are. I totally agree. Jennifer Aniston is hilarious, and we're so used to thinking her as this big sort of celebrity entity. Her actual comedic chops are totally, totally overlooked. I think the same goes for, you know, Lisa Kudrow. I mean, she is so funny, and she has continued to be so funny in so many different ways. I
yes.
mean, The Comeback, I think, is one of the all-time greatest shows ever. And Lisa, I mean, Courtney Cox, she is incredible physical comedian. If you look at that, she is like a full body comedian, and it worked so well for the character, for this like hyper and obsessive and incredibly competitive character. She really embodied that, and I don't think people give her enough credit for that either.
And if you see Jennifer Aniston in some of her movies, I mean, she was in one of my favorite movies that a lot of people don't remember. She's the One, which was Ed Burns, I think, second
mm-hmm.
movie after Brothers McMullen. She played one of the characters' wives who divorces him, and she's very funny, and that makes funny jokes about being married, funny jokes about him. Her parents in the movie wonder that he's gay, and she goes off on, you know, why are you bothering me? It was very funny stuff. And of course, another movie she did with Ben Stiller, Along Came Polly, which her character mm-hmm. is very funny and very different in that. But yeah, I think in Friends, that's one of the things that did make it a good show, is you're right. If people aren't tuning in to see these good-looking people, that will last only a little while, because if it's not interesting beyond that, you're turning the channel. They also had a few great surprises. There was, you know, when I think Chandler and Monica end up in bed together the first time, they're on a trip, and suddenly you see the room and two of them are under the covers, and I'm like, oh my God, these two are together. Or when Rachel and Ross reconnect, every time they did, seemed to keep it fresh and have interesting little side bits. And you had the guest characters, Tom Selleck came in as her boyfriend, and some others that you said, the ER guys that showed up on a show. What was the dimension, you think, that made it interesting? Was it just the writing or the acting ability of these piece or all together?
You know, another thing that does often get overlooked is the writing, which is unbelievably solid, especially for a show that was on the air for as long as it was. I mean, it really maintained quality in many ways. Certainly not everything they did, particularly in the later years, was as good as they did in their prime. It was a solidly well-written show and something that they were very committed to. You know, if a joke didn't get the laugh that they wanted from the live audience, they would rewrite it on the spot.
Oh, wow.
And they would do tons of rewrites right on the spot. You know, I wrote about the episode where they do the trivia contest. And I think it was David Crane who said, you know, there's this one line that we just did it 20 times to get the laugh louder and louder and louder. And we just did it knowing it could be better. And so sometimes they'd have to swap out the audience and they'd go until 2 a.m. just to keep, you know, so the audience would be fresh. And they would just keep rewriting and keep tweaking and keep upping the ante and really paying attention to the audience reaction. So I think the writing is a huge part of it. And certainly the cast, as I said, is incredibly well matched. That was really sort of the lightning in a bottle kind of thing about Friends, is that not only did they have these very talented actors who had really good comedic chops, but they all worked really well together and they had this incredible chemistry, which gave that on-screen friendship a sense of real aliveness, because they did have this really strong off-screen bond, and that can't be discounted either.
Yeah, that's something I think people learned about them. The cast really seemed to be friends. They all got along very well off-screen, mm-hmm. and even didn't they join together to get raises and make sure they all made the same money? That was another
story
that came out. What do you think it is about them that made them, and were they all the original character choices? Were there actors who were maybe originally going to be on the show that weren't?
Oh, gosh, yeah. Well, there's a whole, I mean, the section on casting is huge, right? Because that in and of itself is like, it's quite a journey, quite a story that I think people will be shocked by, because they basically auditioned everyone working in television at that point. And they did offer, I think they offered one role. They offered the role of Chandler to the actor Craig Bierko, who turned it down. They auditioned people like Leah Remini, and, you know, they were considering offering two of the parts to women from Facts of Life. I mean, a lot of famous names that you would know. So, no, I mean, the answer is no. There was only one character that was written for an actor, and that was the role of Ross for David Schwimmer. And everything else was just sort of miraculous casting, really, and rigorous casting.
And do you think it helped the fact that these were unknown people? None of them really had a career. I mean, David Schwimmer had something of a career. He'd been in a Billy Joel video, is how I know him from. And I don't know, did he do any other shows or movies before that?
Oh, yeah. He was on, he did a lot of, I think, you know, cop dramas, I believe. Ah, okay. He was also on a show called Monty with Henry Winkler. He was around, but he had never really broken through. And he was really much more interested in working with his theater company in Chicago. And he had basically decided after Monty that he was done with television.
Oh my God.
And yeah. He did not want to come back. He knew about the script. He knew that they had written the part for him. He was friendly with Marta and David, but he was just really, he felt really burned by TV. But then they got, you know, a bunch of his sort of director heroes to call him on the phone and say, please, come on, just read the script, just come out one more time. And they did, and they got him. Yeah. Oh, but I'm sorry, but the other one. Yeah, Courtney Cox was certainly the best known. You know, she had been on Family Ties. She was in
She had been Michael J. Fox's girlfriend near the end of Family Ties. And she'd been also, speaking of videos, in the Bruce Springsteen Dancing in the Dark video, which went back at least to 84, 85, I think. So, but none of them had the breakthrough name that they later had. So I wonder, sometimes that helps more. People get a fresh look, get a fresh face, and they don't have preconceived notions. I didn't realize the Facts of Life girls had been. That would have definitely brought in an early audience, probably. How did it do in the early ratings? Did the show rate well from the beginning? Because, like you said, it had a good time slot, or did it take time?
It was fine. It wasn't amazing. It was definitely iffy at the beginning, particularly because the reviews were really snarky and really just sort of brushed it off as something that was going to, you know, oh, it's just a blonder version of Seinfeld. It's going to go away in a second. It's just about marketing. They're just trying to market it. And it was really, really dismissed critically. And sometimes the ratings were good and sometimes they were like really not good. But there was sort of a slow sort of simmer over that first season. And then what happened was, it was the summer reruns after the first season. That's when everybody discovered it. seemingly overnight. And at the same time, of course, the theme song was this very popular song on the radio. That combined with, you know, this big Rolling Stone cover articles with these, you know, really cool flashy images, that really combined to help a lot of people discover the show in summer reruns. And when they came back for season two, things just blew up.
Two quick things. There's you do a whole chapter on Rachel's hairdo, or at least part of it.
It's not a whole chapter. It's sort of the framework.
A framework, but which is valid. What is it about that? My wife will get a haircut and it looks somewhat like hers, and she'll say, "I'm Rachel now," you know, and this is, you know, how many years later? And there were a lot of other references. I know people, Joey would always say, "How you doing?" And I know people who will say that in that voice for that reason. And as you say, you name each of your chapters the one about. And the funny thing is, if you go look at the reruns, that's how they describe them, which I don't think a lot of shows do that. What is it about the Rachel hair or other things that have sort of stayed in the pulp culture element?
I mean, I use Rachel as sort of the entry point into this section where I wanted to talk about the sort of phenomenon of Friends, the way that it kind of jumped off of the television screen and into the rest of our lives. The way that, you know, think what we were talking about earlier, the way that it sort of began to both reflect but also heavily influence fashion and clothing purchasing trends at the time, you know, certainly became a jumping off point for a lot of other television shows, sort of Friends that were trying to find the quote-unquote Friends formula. And I think that Rachel, that haircut is just so representative of how ubiquitous and how overwhelmingly popular that show became. Because if you think back to that time, I mean, again, I was an adolescent and I got that haircut, I don't know, two or three times. And so did every sort of woman and girl that I knew. And it became sort of a rite of passage. And that haircut has certainly not fully gone away. And what's funny is that it's actually a haircut that's kind of a pain to maintain. You really need to have like a big roller brush and a hair dryer. It doesn't actually look all that great, I think, personally, on a lot of people. Certainly, I hated the way it looked on me. And yet I kept getting my hair cut that way, I think two or three times before I finally stopped, because it was the haircut. And I wanted it, even though I knew that it wasn't really a good haircut. And even Jennifer Aniston hated it as well. She was like, "Oh, I got to blow dry my hair every single day, or I have to have somebody do it for me. It's like, it's a pain." And so I think that's a good symbol of the power that Friends really developed, the power and its sort of cultural cachet.
And a lot of shows, of course, you go back to the Beatles as far as haircuts go, and Elvis and all people through history. That's been an image, a way people can identify with a show or a movie or a TV character or a singer. And then in the 70s and somewhat in the 80s, you had the phrases.
Farrah Fawcett, right? Phrases.
Yeah, but you're talking about Farrah Fawcett. That's right. I didn't even think of that one. She's another haircut that a lot of people had, a lot of the 70s hair. In the 80s, you had a lot of hair bands, you know, a lot of the rock music, and some actors. But you also had the phrases. In the 70s, it was, you know, Dynamite and and Sit on It on Happy Days, or A, or all these other shows. In the 80s, I don't know that you had a lot of that. Seinfeld, though, came through, as you know, with a lot of phrases that are still in the lexicon. But in Friends, you had, like I said, the Joey character's phrase, the idea that you refer to it as the one that this happened, the one that happened, still identifies the show. But I wanted to give you one other quick question, and I appreciate your time. We did mention this a little earlier when we were talking, and you do a chapter on homophobia on the show, that there's, and this might be just a sign of the life in the 90s, as some gay characters were starting to come on TV, and now obviously you have whole main characters, which is great. And what was it about that chapter and that view you wanted to explain? I know you're a fan of the show, but you also seem to have good criticism when needed. Was that just thing of the time, or did the show miss a chance to be a little bit more progressive in that area?
Well, thanks for bringing that up. I just want to say, first of all, that it was really important to me to, you know, strike that balance, because a lot of people think that either you can love a show or it's total garbage. You know, it's like one or the other. And I think, I just don't think that's true. And it was really important to me to touch on things like the transphobia with Chandler's dad, with the total lack of racial and ethnic diversity, you know, the treatment of Fat Monica, certainly, you know, the weird sort of relationship that the show had with its Jewish characters, which is really complicated. And I go into all those things in the book as well. And of course, you know, off-screen sort of controversial things as well. Like I do have a whole big section on the harassment lawsuit towards the end of the book. But the homophobia chapter I thought was a really good entry point for talking about all of that, because I wanted to do an in-depth chapter on that, because I think that one element really shows how Friends was indeed a product of its time. It is the treatment of the gay characters on the show is such a don't ask, don't tell era thing.
Right. Sure.
It's very much, so we have this really iconic episode, the one with the lesbian wedding,
right.
And you have these two women getting married, and it is incredible. It's the first on television, the first time two women are getting married, and that's a really big deal. And they even push the envelope even further by, I don't know if you noticed this part, Newt Gingrich's sibling plays the officiant.
Right.
And they're not named, but there they are. Candace Gingrich is a genderqueer individual who uses they, them pronouns, and they work for the Human Rights Campaign, fun fact. And so that was a very big move.
And there had been a gay wedding on Roseanne.
Oh, yeah.
But it had been two gay men, not two gay women.
Exactly. Right, there had been two gay men. There had also been, the first one was on a show called Rock. And I really encourage anybody who wasn't familiar with that to go back and revisit that episode, because they did an incredible job. And that's a really fascinating chapter of television history. But I digress. The one with the lesbian wedding was a big envelope pushing episode and a really important one. At the same time, the way that the wedding was done is very, very, very what we would call heteronormative. Now it is heteronormative. It's very traditional,
right,
in that the women are wearing these very long, very feminine dresses. And I quote the costume designer in the book saying, it was really important to me that these look like, as she said, real women, which I think really exemplifies the sort of attitude about gay people at that time, which was, okay, we're going to push this envelope, but we're also going to be really careful, and we're going to make it sort of easier to swallow. You know, one of the brides is walked down the aisle by her father, who's in full military garb.
Oh, boy.
And, of course, they didn't have them kiss at the wedding. The women, the actresses, wanted that to happen, but I think producers felt that would be... They were afraid, frankly, of the reaction. And, you know, I can understand that fear, I suppose. Now, being the first is scary. But looking back, and there's been quite a lot written about this by queer writers and cultural critics, you know, they could have done so much more. And if we had a lesbian wedding on television now, I think it would be a lot less tense. There would be a lot more love.
Yeah.
That the women would get to kiss. And I think it would just look differently. I find that a really fascinating episode to explore. Again, that happened right after Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Yes. And one of the women had been Ross's ex-wife, or
mm-hmm.
he had had his child with, right? Because I know there are many episodes where he's visiting his son, but his son's mother was one of those women. They were in the show off and on. It wasn't just like they had two friends who were getting married and they wrote it into the show. One of them was a reoccurring character who still had
connection to them. They were, and that was great.
And I remember seeing that show. I don't remember the fact that they didn't kiss. That seems odd. That's the one part of a wedding that is always the same, pretty much. So if you're going to have a lesbian wedding, you'd think people would expect them to kiss. I mean, it doesn't have to be some big, passionate kiss. It could just even do sort of a simple kiss. And would that be any more offensive to people who are offended by that kind of thing than the fact that they had a wedding at all? It just seemed...
Well, see, and that's a very good point. Yeah. And one thing that's sort of a nice little add-on to this story is the fact that NBC expected to get zillions and zillions of angry phone calls, and so they hired all this temporary staff to man the phones the night of the episode. And they got, I think in the end, it was two people called, and that was it.
That says a lot.
That was it.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Anyway, what would be the one thing people would be surprised about the show that you found out in your research and reporting?
I mean, I think we've touched on a lot of them, you know, especially in terms of the casting. But, you know, there's the whole story, as you said, about them banding together and the way that they negotiated as a union. And that was a first in television. And so far, it hasn't been successfully replicated, not to that degree. But there's so much of the, you know, the story behind the show, I think, is as compelling as the show itself. It's hard to pinpoint one thing, but you know, I did mention the harassment suit.
Yeah, remind
earlier.
Us of what happened there. I didn't recall that.
Yeah,
when did that occur?
That happened off screen. That happened. Well, it first began in 1999 when a writer's assistant was fired. Her name was Amani Lyle. She is now a communication strategist, and she works at the Pentagon. She was a writer's assistant back then, and she was the only woman of color in the room. And she was really shocked by what went down in the room. And you know, this was. A sort of particularly notorious time in television in terms of the fact that every single room was dominated by straight white men, and it was very, very exclusionary, and there was a lot of behavior that we would now identify, you know, as harassment and as hostile, extremely.
Was it like racial harassment or sexual harassment?
Both. I mean, she sued for both racial and sexual harassment.
If you're saying this was in 1999?
Yes.
So that was right around the time of Bill Clinton's scandal. an impeachment too. So
I suppose that's true. Yeah. And but her case actually continued. You know, she was in and out of the court until 2006. It actually went all the way to the California Supreme Court.
Oh boy.
And what was interesting was the writers took what was described as an entirely unique defense. This had never been done before. The writers basically said that many of the allegations that Amani Lyle made were true, that they had said and done many of the things that she had, you know, accused them of. Mm-hmm. But what they said was, in that context, it was not harassment. It was, quote unquote, creative necessity.
Interesting.
So essentially, yeah, they said because they were in a writer's room and because they were writers, that it was all just part of the process and it was a necessary part of the process to do these things. And I don't really want to repeat them here, but I think you can guess what I'm saying. And there's, you know, I go into detail in the book. And in the end, the California Supreme Court sided with them and agreed with the creative necessity defense. And that became a precedent-setting case that actually had an enormous impact on workplaces all over the country. It's been, I mean, check your HR materials and you will probably see that case referenced. Because, you know, it makes it harder for people to raise harassment claims in, you know, many different kinds of workplace environments. It's used in journalism, in education, certainly in entertainment. Anyway, I find that to be a very, very important story that I think everybody should know about, no matter
where. That's a very interesting precedent and issue. Was she claiming that they were harassing her specifically, or were they were saying offensive things that would be deemed offensive to her?
No, she claimed that the behavior and the commentary that they were making, while, you know, for the most part, they weren't making the comments and directing the behavior, for the most part, not at her directly, but it was sort of the constant commentary,
right,
and the constant sort of terrible things that they were doing and filling the room and making it sort of impossible for anybody to raise a complaint. And if anybody did complain, you know, they got kind of shut down or kicked out. And she, you know, is pretty unequivocal about the fact that that's why she was fired from the show so fast.
Could Friends be what it was today, given a lot of the things we've talked about? Or would it just have to be different? Would it have to be multiracial or have a gay character or a lesbian character or other characters? Or it seems like it'd be hard to do that show today, given all the issues that arose and where we are today with pop culture and diversity on TV.
Well, you know, it's interesting to put it that way, because to me, it's just, I don't think that it would have altered the show all that much if one of them or more of them happened to, you know, not be straight or not be white. If anything, I think that would have, you know, made the story, you know, given it a little more depth and
right,
probably given them more places, more things to talk about. As the, you know, the show went on for 10 years and they did have to stretch at some point. And I think diversity doesn't make it harder to do anything. I don't think that it would have to be like, you know, a very special episode about one of the gay friends. I think it's totally doable because, as I say, in the end, yes, there are plenty of things about the show that are incredibly like 90s, but really it's a show that is about something totally, totally timeless, which is the experience of having friends. It is. It's about just like being in your 20s in that time in your life when your friends are your family. And that is very much still true today. And that is true for people of all sorts of racial and ethnic and backgrounds and sexualities and genders. That is absolutely true. And I think you could definitely do a show like this with a cast like that. Sure. Yeah. It wouldn't take away from it at all.
But you'd have to have it be a different kind of show. Like you said, we would have to have more diversity, I would think, which would probably make it better in many ways.
Yeah. It feels funny to me because it's like they could have had, you know, more diversity back then. It,
yeah,
it wasn't the norm and they chose not to break that norm. I think that, as you point out, television, as we've talked about, is still overwhelmingly white. There are still shows where, for the most part, you know, all our lead characters are white. There's a statistic that I cited from GLAAD in the end. I mean, it's still a fractional percentage of characters on TV. They were talking about gay characters.
Right.
A tiny, tiny amount. And for the most part, all the gay characters on television are straight. I'm sorry. All the gay characters on television are white and male. So,
right.
I mean, that says something. So, yeah, I mean, it's also the fact that, like, we don't often do sitcoms in this style anymore. So it would be a different show, but you could still certainly do a show that had this concept that could be just as well done. Absolutely.
Is there any talk or ever been any thought of a reunion? Or,
sure. I mean,
special.
As long
that would
as
it would make big money. And where are they all today? And they're grown up now. And I mean, the show ended in 2004.
2004. So we're coming up on years the 25th anniversary, yeah.
You have Ross's child is a lot older. You have, where are the characters? Where have they gone? I know they did a spinoff with Joey briefly in California. He moved out there, and it would seem to be a no-brainer in terms of making money, but has it ever really gotten to the point of serious consideration among the actors or producers?
You know, the sort of lovely thing about the actors on Friends is that they, as I was told by their representatives when I reached out about this book, they still have that all-for-one, one-for-all deal in place. When it comes to Friends-related stuff, they have, what they have always done is get together privately and make the decision together without even getting their reps involved, and then coming to the table and negotiating as a group. They still do that. So I kind of love that. I don't think that that reunion show will happen. I think it's possible that they'll do something for the 25th anniversary, but I sort of can't imagine it's a Where Are They Now episode. Because, again, it's a show about a very particular time in life, which they have all aged out of. And I don't think that anybody really, if they think about it, any fan wants to see those people still sort of stuck in time in their 40s and 50s now, still living in the same apartment, still having the same problems, still, you know, sort of not having moved on in life. And I think it's best to leave it where it is. I think that reruns are great. And I also think, as we've talked about, this is a very well-paid cast, and it's a cast that was the first to get back-end residuals as actors. So I don't think they're looking for a big money deal at the moment. I mean, maybe some more than others, but I think it would take quite a lot of money to entice them to do something like this.
Yeah, and they would probably figure, well, what's in it for us? Is there really a plus to it? Probably not.
Yeah, I mean... Yeah.
But you could do a show where they came back, you moved up in time. I'm not saying you do a show where they're still all living in the same apartment building. You talk about, where is everybody today? And one person's married to someone and living somewhere else, and they come together for some event, maybe one of the kids' weddings or something. But again, you're right. Do you really gain anything from that? Other than seeing them all older and maybe not as young and hip as they were.
Right. And there's nothing, you know, wrong with that. I don't know. For me, I think it's more fun to imagine. You know, I really do. I think it's fun to let this be, to let that show be what it was and to really enjoy it for what it was. I personally think that a reunion would ruin it. That's I'm in that camp. I know that there are people in another camp, but that's my take. But that said, I would be surprised if we didn't see something happen for the 25th anniversary.
Well, that might be more of an interview kind of thing. They'll come on the Today Show or something, or even their own special, an NBC special or something. Reunion, the cast, 25th anniversary of the Friends. Let's talk, here's the cast, and they talk to Hoda Kotb or somebody from NBC for an hour and look back at flashbacks. But you're right, there's probably more downside possibility to a new show than an upside, because it was such a hit, it left on a high. They're all doing other things now. And as you said, they're still making money off it. But it's one thing that I'm sure is always asked and will probably continue to be asked. Okay, I've kept you longer than I asked. Thank you, Kelsey Miller. We'll tell you again, I'll Be There For You, the one about Friends. The book is out. It's a really good read about pop elements of the show, but also some great background and inside information and some controversies that we talked about. And the book goes well more into them than we did. Thank you for being with us, and we'll look forward to your next projects down the road.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
And that's all for this week's edition of The Retro Room. Thanks for listening. Remember, my book is out, Killing Journalism, How Greed, Laziness, and Donald Trump Are Destroying News and How We Can Save It. And a quick reminder to give Jiminy's Dog Treats to your dog. Cricket protein is hypoallergenic, humane, nutritious, delicious, and fights climate change. Reduce your carbon pawprint with Jiminy's Dog Treats at Jiminy's.com. That's Jiminy's.com. Thanks again for listening. Tune in next time to another Retro Room. Have a great day.